So, welcome back to the Birdie Bug Pod,
episode 49. We're getting very close to 50.
Well, 49 is quite close to 50, isn't it?
It's we keep saying we need to plan something for our 50th.
Have we planned anything for it?
No, but we will.
It's going to be big.
It's going to be huge.
It's not going to be as big as 100, though.
No, it's going to be like the Super Bowl halftime show, isn't it?
I feel like we need Dr. Dre or something. Yeah.
Anyway, welcome back.
Or Beyonce.
Yeah.
No, not Beyonce. I wouldn't have Beyonce. I'd probably have Eminem or something like
that. Yeah, that'd be pretty cool. Anyway. Yeah.
Anyway.
Welcome back to the Birdie Bug Pod. It's nice to be recording in the sunshine. Last time I sat here, we had the rain hitting the
roof. Yes, we did. And it's actually been, we haven't had any rain for ages here.
So it's nice to have a nice sunny day. And what's cool is you would always think that our episode focusing on insects and invertebrates, which is what we're going to be talking about today, would come from me. But this was actually your idea.
Yeah, I had this idea of the importance of invertebrates.
Yeah, I very much focused on the insects, true to fashion.
Because I just think that they're underappreciated.
Always.
And particularly from conservation point of view, which we'll talk about later on in the episode. But I also, I don't know why I wanted to do this one, apart from the fact I read a couple of really, I think I was doing something about caffeine and I came up with this, found this great fact about coffee plants and
insects getting high on caffeine.
Yeah, absolutely. So that then I thought, do you know, it's a really cool fact. And what we're going to try and do today, because it could be an enormous subject for obvious reasons.
I mean, I would just like to point out that when you sort of proposed this, I was like, okay, cool, yeah, I'll talk about insects. And I've turned up today and you've gone all invertebrates. And I'm like, oh my God, that's
well,
a big
topic.
Well,
it's because it's called the importance of invertebrates. Yeah. It's not called the importance of insects.
Yeah.
Well, although insects are invertebrates.
Exactly.
In fact, while we're there, do you want me to tell you the six main groups of invertebrates, or should I tell you that in a minute?
Tell me that in a minute.
Catch up.
Yeah. Do you have any?
You were worried today, so we didn't have an agenda, and I feel like we're now, because of that, we're all over the place, so it could be a loose episode.
Be fine. Catch up.
Catch
go.
Up. I don't have any catch up apart from I've done a few more breeding bird surveys, I've done a few more shifts at Pagham. I went to the Nepa State for the first time, which I've been meaning to do, and I think I've mentioned it on the episodes before. It's 20 minutes up the road, the most amazing rewilding project in Europe, actually. And I visited it yesterday for the first time, which was pretty cool. Apart from that, apart from having 6 million starlings in my garden that are eating me out of house and home, I don't have much more than that. But you've got a bit.
A little bit. I mean, I can join you in that now because I finally have a garden. I think we mentioned that I moved house in a few episodes ago, which was why we took a bit of a break. But I now, for the first time in my life, have a proper garden and it's absolutely full to the brim with young starlings and their parents. And it's been lovely to watch. So all I've done is either watch them or go out and buy more food for them.
And send me videos.
And send
them.
You a lot of videos. So,
which has been so cool to see your lawn. And it's not a huge lawn, but there must have been 15 starlings bobbing about in your lawn.
So it's lovely to now actually have a space for wildlife. We've spoken so much about the importance of gardening. I'm going to speak about it today. So I'm pleased that I can finally join.
Which I also will hasten to add that it was nice to see you're leaving your lawn to grow.
Because
it's no mow May, everybody. Don't forget that. Leave you a little patch, even if it's just a little patch of your garden or your lawn, leave it untidy, leave the lawn to grow a bit longer without cutting it for the whole of May. It's ever so beneficial at this time for the birds,
for
the invertebrates. For the butterflies, which are invertebrates,
I've really enjoyed
all of those things.
Whilst when the grass got a little bit longer, the starlings almost disappear into it like some sort of savannah, and then you just see them pop up with some grubs in their beak. So that's really lovely. Otherwise, I haven't been up to much. In the last episode, we mentioned that I ran my first marathon, and then this week I ran my first 50K. So that's all I've really been doing.
That's all. 50K off-road.
Just running. Right.
Crazy.
Probably plenty.
So the importance of invertebrates, and I'm going to start off with a quote from David Attenborough.
Yes, do that.
Of the importance of invertebrates. Invertebrates, if you didn't know, and I'm sure that you do, are a subset of the animal kingdom that lacks a backbone, as opposed to vertebrates.
Which is what we are.
And David Attenborough said, if we and the rest of the backboned animals were to disappear overnight, the rest of the world would get on pretty well. But if the invertebrates were to disappear, the world's ecosystems would collapse.
Yeah, and I mean, we've spoken about it in lots of episodes where, you know, we focus quite heavily on a variety of bird species, and so often it ties into our declining insect populations that are then impacting our birds and causing them to decline, because they are, apart from plants, very much at the base of the ecological chain. So you take away the base, obviously everything above it collapses. We should say that whereas in most episodes we pick one species or one habitat and follow it through, this is a little bit more similar to our sort of positive news episodes that we do sort of around Christmassy time, where we've just gone out and found a collection of interesting facts, case studies, things people might not know, cool things about invertebrates and insects and their lifestyle, just to sort of rattle through them as a variety of case studies, rather than picking one topic and working our way through the entire thing. It's more of a whistle-stop tour of, oh my God, how awesome is the
We're going to have to be quite slick, because I found so many references. But
I could have done a whole episode on termites.
I mean, just to give you a little bit of an indication of the magnitude of the task, there are over 1.3 million species that we know of invertebrates. And again, just to give you a heads up on the groups of invertebrates, there are six main groups: arthropods, which are insects, spiders and crustaceans.
Well, I wonder how many I can guess.
Okay, go on then.
I did a degree in this at one
arthropods,
point.
Arthropods, obviously, you would have guessed, which are insects, spiders and...
Yeah, well, it's all joint-legged creatures.
Crustaceans.
You've also got, we've spoken before the podcast, got the cnidarians,
which are
like sea sponges and things like
and
that.
And jellyfish and sea anemones.
You've got the peripherans. I don't know if that's how
haven't
you say
got
it.
That down.
How do you say it? Hang on. Let me give
I
you
haven't a... got those down.
Peripherans?
No. I've got...
No?
No. What are you
oh,
saying?
Oh, they're the sponges.
Oh, is that what they are?
Yeah,
okay, I have got sponges on there. What else you got?
Annelids.
I haven't got, annelids. I've got segmented worms.
Oh, annelids are your worms.
Okay, that's fine. So you're going good.
Got the mollusks.
Mollusks is the next one. There's one more.
One more. Hang on. Echinoderms.
Bang on.
They're, which are your like your urchins.
Starfish,
and
sea
like
cucumbers,
that.
And sea urchins. Good job. Good job.
Thank you, sir. I mean, it was a degree question at one point, so I'm pleased I remember it.
On the basis that there are over 1.3 million species of invertebrates, to give you an idea of how that relates to vertebrates in numbers, there are about 5,000 mammal species, 10,000 bird species, and insects alone account for at least a million species of invertebrates.
Yeah, the stat I've always liked to use is that 5,000 mammals, for example, and then there's roughly 360,000 species of beetle.
Yeah,
and it's just like that's an insane number. And I think it's also really worth pointing out that we've got about a million insects that we have described. But it's estimated that there could be another, well, in total, 5.5 million insect species, which means almost 80%, if that estimation is sort of correct, are still undiscovered. So we've got all these species. It's not even, it's 20% of what could be out there. So they...
God knows how many under the sea.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Wow. So they make up an insane volume of life on Earth. I think... I quite like this stat that insects, so again, I'm focusing quite heavily here on the specific invertebrate group is insects, collectively weigh 300 times more than all the humans, which I quite liked.
Yeah, I actually also read a stat that the total biomass of ants alone on the planet equals, I don't know how they work this out, equals the total biomass of all humans.
Yeah.
And that's just the ants. So again,
there's quite a lot of them.
And what I think is will come out of this episode today is that we immediately think, because of those numbers and because of those ridiculous stats and because of examples like from biomass point of view, there are more than 100,000 species of terrestrial arthropods in a single hectare of the Amazon rainforest. We all immediately think there are so many that they're not under threat. They're not in decline. There's always such an abundance. But actually, one of the focuses of this episode is to highlight, yes, the importance of invertebrates, but also that, like a lot of the species and a lot of the subjects that we've been talking about, they are under threat.
Yeah, well, I mean, that stat that you've just given about the rainforest, we're always hearing about how many hectares are lost every hour or every day, for example. Yeah. If you think of then the biomass of invertebrates that are being lost as
100,000 well. 100,000 in one hectare.
And again, the statistic which we've mentioned in a few episodes is that 41% of all insect species globally are in decline. They are declining quite rapidly.
And of course, that's having a massive ripple effect on the whole ecosystem, because invertebrates, they pollinate, they disperse seeds, they're food for wildlife, they recycle nutrients, they clean water, they build reefs, and they're absolutely critical to life on planet. With, as David Attenborough said, without them, the whole ecosystem of our planet would collapse.
Yeah, I mean, to put sort of monetary value to insects, it's estimated they contribute $235 to $577 billion a year just in crop pollination. So that's not even all of the other services that they provide ecologically, just in pollination, up to $577 billion every single year.
And to finish up on the stats thing, because we're bombarding you with stats, this was one that really blew my mind. Of all the animals on Earth, up to 97% of all animals on Earth are invertebrates, which means there's only 3% are the rest, mammals and whatever else is left. Isn't that incredible?
Yeah, it is incredible. It really is their world, and we just live in it.
They've also been around for a very, very long time. They reckon 600 million years ago, they reckon, that invertebrates. And of course, invertebrates with no backbone, they don't leave a skeleton.
Not as often. It's normally as often. Imprint,
so it's actually really difficult and very frustrating for paleontologists to actually estimate how long invertebrates have been on the planet. Obviously, there's been lots of fossilized ones that have obviously been caught in, you know, rock formations, what have you. But they've been around, they reckon they could be as far back as a billion years ago invertebrates were first on the planet.
So, makes sense.
So they've been around a long time.
I just wanted to throw this in here, and I just had to really quickly Google the number because I really love this as a stat. Obviously, you said they've been around for a long time. There's a really great idea that actually the crab, like the structure and formation of crabs, is the pinnacle of evolution. And if given enough time, we will all evolve to be crabs, because separately, crabs have evolved 17 different times. So rather than it just being one lineage, you know, crab evolved and everything's diverged from there, 17 separate occasions has ended up in a crab-like organism. And so it must be so evolutionarily favourable, because it just keeps on happening. So given enough time, we will all be crabs.
I love that.
I just love the idea that it's actually potentially one of the most effective lifestyles and formations, because it's been so successful throughout
history. That is so cool.
So really, we should all be crabs.
We should all be crabs. Do you know what the largest invertebrate in the world is?
It's a big old squid.
It's a big old squid called the Krantz squid. It can weigh over 500 kilograms, reach lengths of 14 meters. Do you know the longest one, though? Because although that's the largest, it's not the longest.
It's going to be some sort of worm, isn't it?
It is some sort of worm. It can grow up to 180 feet long.
That's mental. That's a big worm.
It's a big worm. It's called a ribbon worm. And there are other fascinating facts, like clams can live for over 400 years. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Basically, welcome to the episode where our mind is blown by invertebrates.
Absolutely blown away by these things. So a fascinating subject that I could talk about forever.
Famously, I've never really needed too much excuse to talk about insects and spiders.
You love insects, don't you? But there were some great little things. This was the one that started me off, was coffee and citrus flowers produce caffeinated nectar, which has a pharmacological effect on honeybees and bumblebees. And what it does is it enhances their memory, which is often why we have a slug of caffeine in the morning.
That's why we use it before exams.
So that enhances the memory for the unique smells that emanate from those flowers, and it helps to bring the bees back and know that, you know, they keep coming back for obviously to get their caffeine fix, but obviously to benefit the plant, which I thought was just a great little fact about invertebrates.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually got one of the things that I've sort of focused on is a variety of what I've dubbed specialist pollinators, and these are plants that have sort of evolved in a way that requires quite a specific type of insect to pollinate them, so it's not just sort of a free-for-all. And one of the most famous ones, obviously, is the cacao plant, which is where we get chocolate from, which relies really heavily on midges very specifically midges, which again, people always hate, you know, biting.
If you've ever been to Scotland in the midge season, you'll know why.
But again, the chocolate plant or the cacao tree, which is where we get chocolate, relies almost exclusively on tiny midges from a family that I'm not going to try and pronounce. And so that's a quite a specialist one. The one I liked was passion fruit and carpenter bees. So apparently the passion fruit flowers are really quite complex and require a large bodied pollinator for the pollination to be effective. So carpenter bees from another Xylocopa species, I think, is that for carpenter bees. And they're essentially, because they're so chunky, they're capable of being in contact with both the anthers and the stigmas, therefore facilitating the pollen transfer really effectively. And it's to the point where in areas where the natural pollinators are quite scarce, humans have to go out and do it by hand because the other insects aren't up to the task. So really you need these big chunky carpenter bees. And there are all sorts of really cool examples. The same with Brazil nuts. Only large-bodied bees are able to actually be strong enough to access the complicated floral structure of the Brazil nut. The reason why I really liked this one is that because the Brazil nut tree depends so heavily on these big bees for pollination and literally will not fruit without them, you can't grow Brazil nut trees in like a big monoculture plantation because the pollinators disappear. So they can only be grown in and around biodiverse forests because they need these big beautiful bees that won't survive in a monoculture. So it's a real great example of the fact that you're forced to look after a bit of nature if you want your Brazil nuts, because you can't have a diverse variety of bees in a monoculture. And I absolutely love that.
Yeah, no, I love that. I like that.
These bees have evolved in such a way that forces us to keep a diverse forest. I think that's just brilliant.
Well, yeah, we need more of it as well. We definitely do. And there are fascinating things about also the impact that invertebrates can have on an ecosystem. And I found this, again, this great example of that. In January, a study found that the arrival of invasive big-headed ants in Kenya had set an ecological chain reaction that led to lions making fewer zebra kills.
Yeah, you mentioned this to me and I had to go and read it because it was just incredible.
The tree cover had fallen in areas where big-headed ants had spread. Obviously, they're eating the leaves of the tree. So it was providing less cover for lions to ambush zebras. And researchers said their findings had a global lesson about the importance of invertebrates. So
it does also show you what can happen with invasive species in such a way that you would never even consider.
Absolutely, absolutely. Which I thought was just absolutely fascinating. So, I mean, I could just reel off lots and lots of amazing examples. We would know much less about genetics than we do today if it wasn't for two widely studied invertebrates.
It's got to be in there.
It was a nematode and a fruit fly.
Yeah, fruit fly is Drosophila.
So with its well-differentiated organs, a fruit fly helped researchers decode the genes that produce specific anatomical traits, for example. So that was amazing.
Drosophila, which is the fruit fly, is the invert or the animal version of the Arabidopsis plant. It's like the model organism that we've used for everything from genetics to all sorts of studies. They're like, they are the model lab organism. So they've
I've got a little quiz question for you.
Oh God.
What do you think this is?
There are quite a lot of sounds in there. Am I trying to ID like the whoop, whoop, whoop or the little
thing? Yeah, that is a kind of habitat that's making that noise. That's my hint to you.
I think it's got to be some sort of either a log pile, maybe a beehive. You've got the larvae scratching away in there. I'll go for maybe a beehive.
Do you know what that is the sound of? That is the sound of a coral reef.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay.
Is the sound of shrimps. Apparently it sounds like frying bacon.
Yeah, it does actually.
And that is the sound of shrimps feeding on a coral reef. Because I've got to be honest, I must be really ignorant about this. I didn't realise that coral reefs were invertebrates.
Yes, a lot of people think they're almost like a plant.
Yeah, and obviously the Great Barrier Reef is the largest structure on Earth built by living organisms, and I didn't know that. It can be seen from space. And corals look like rocks, but they're actually invertebrate animals within the phylum Nidaria.
Yeah, Nidaria.
Nidaria.
Oh, actually, I've said that like Nidaria. I've corrected you. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it.
So I didn't know that, which I thought that was quite interesting. But that sound is produced by snapping shrimps This small shrimp, which is about 3 to 5 centimetres long, it uses their unique pincers to produce a very loud pop of bubbles, so powerful that it stuns or kills small fish, and that's the noise.
It's a bit like the mantis shrimp.
Yeah, so I thought that was quite cool. I've got another little quiz question for you. How many eggs does a shrimp produce in one spawning?
Oh, I don't know. 137.
Oh, that is definitely up with my curly. 137 eggs.
Well, I don't know. 2,000.
Definitely up with my 6 kilogram curly.
I don't think. I think
in
shrimp
one spawning, 500,000.
That's quite a lot of eggs, isn't it?
137. I love that.
I would like to say that you are a bird person. I'm not a shrimp person.
No, that is true. I'm an insect person. That's a good point.
So you back off.
Right. Well, I've got another really fun thing which made me laugh out loud, and actually I will make reference to Sophie Pavello. I think is someone that you know, and
I don't know her, but
you obviously are a big fan of Sophie Pavello.
Yeah, I've been a big fan of Sophie Pavello for a while. I like her book, and
she does a podcast with
I work with Emma Brisdian,
yeah,
who does a podcast with Sophie Pavello. So I know her through that,
and she is so cool, and she has done a really cool 1 minute long YouTube video about this particular invertebrate, which we'll put a link to in the show notes, because this made me really laugh. Did you know about the Lesser Water Boatman's Penis Orchestra?
I did not, no.
So despite their small size, insects make themselves heard. The male lesser water boatman, at just a few millimetres in length, produces the loudest sound made by any animal relative to its body size on the planet, apparently. And in a bid to attract a mate, it rubs its penis-like reproductive organ against its abdomen to make a loud snapping noise. The sound produced is a staggering 99.2 decibels, which is equivalent to standing 15 metres away from a passing train or sitting in the front row of an orchestra in full swing. Sophie Pavell does this absolutely hilarious 1 minute YouTube video. We'll put a link to it,
because
it's very, very cool. Because I didn't realise until I was researching this water boatman that she'd done that. But anyway,
that's quite the accolade, isn't it?
I thought that was really cool. Apparently, it's the loudest sound made by any animal relative to its body size. And this thing's less than a centimetre.
I wonder who was the first person to record that.
There are some recordings of it. Sadly, I couldn't get a recording that I could download to put on here, because I was going to put it on here and say, what do you reckon this sound is? And sadly, I couldn't find a recording of it that I could download.
But I want to know is, firstly, who recorded it? And secondly, how do they work out that that's where it was coming from?
Yeah, I know. If you do Google it, there is quite a bit of research made or having been done on this lesser water boatman. I think the BBC did a programme about it. One of the wildlife trusts has done a thing about it. So remarkably, there's more reference to that than you would think. Although it's quite a cool thing, isn't it?
It is. It's just a nice record to hold, really.
Definitely. So what else you got?
I've got fig wasps. You want to know about fig wasps?
I'd love to know about fig wasps.
So it's a 60 million year mutualistic relationship where figs and fig wasps have co-evolved to end up in quite a highly specialised situation. And essentially each fig species is pollinated by a very specific wasp species. And so female wasps enter the fig's enclosed inflorescence through a narrow passage, normally losing their wings in this process. And then inside they pollinate the flowers and lay their eggs. And essentially the developing wasp larva mature within the fig itself. And upon sort of emergence, the male wasps will mate with females and help them basically exit the fig to find a new one to go and pollinate. But it's a really intricate life cycle that ensures the reproduction of both the fig but also the wasp, because they're nice and safe tucked away inside the fig. But it's really cool how each fig species has its own wasp species to pollinate for.
That's
it
amazing.
And it's just a really highly specialized relationship that's developed over 60 million years. It's insane. But I just thought it was really quite cool.
Fascinating. Well, you're obviously concentrating a lot on insects. I want to talk to you about the octopus.
Okay.
Just how clever. I think people know that the octopus is one of the most intelligent animals on the planet.
Yeah, they are insanely smart.
But I didn't realise they do things like this. They've got a very sophisticated navigation system in its brain that helps it navigate complex mazes. They've also been known to solve... See, in this article, it says octopi, and I said to you, is it octopi or octopuses?
Well, apparently, octopi, we looked this up just before we started recording. Otherwise, it just sounds like I've just got a bank of random knowledge. Octopi essentially is the oldest form of the plural, and it was because it was sort of assumed it would follow like the Latin tend for fungus, fungi.
Yeah.
But actually, octopus comes from Greek, and the plural grammatical structure from the Greek language would be octopuses.
Oh, okay. So, but in this article that I've downloaded here, it says octopi.
Well, send them a message and tell them it's not Latin.
I will. So octopi have been known to solve problems and play together, having very impressive short-term memory, but they've also been known to sneak aboard fishing boats and pry open holds to steal captured crabs and can open jars. They use shells and other objects to build defence structures against predators. They're capable of foresight, planning, and they use their tentacles as tools. They also collect bottle caps, attractive stones, and other finds from the ocean floor to decorate their dens. And they reposition an object if it doesn't suit the design.
Do you want to know something else really cool about octopuses?
I really love an octopus.
They've been recorded punching fish out of spite.
Is that true?
Yeah, it was a news article. Went
How did they
ages.
Know it was out of spite?
Because they realised there was no other function for it, but there's a video of
That's
a fish
hilarious.
Swimming past and the octopus just gives it a good old whack.
That's absolutely hilarious. I
mean,
that.
They also have one of the most complex colour-changing abilities in
they
the
are
animal
such
kingdom.
Such a cool animal, octopus.
They are phenomenal. Do you want to know a random fun anecdote?
I'd love to.
In my first year zoology exam for my degree, there was the question, multiple choice, how many arms does an octopus have? And we all just thought, how have you put this in a degree? Like, how is? And we spoke to the lecturer afterwards, and he was like, well, got to make you smile in the middle of an exam, haven't you? And one of my friends got it wrong.
Really? What did he say?
Put 10. And we were just like, he was like, it was so simple. I thought it had to be a trick. There's no way it could be 8. He panicked and put 10.
That's amazing.
Which always makes me chuckle.
Do you know which invertebrate has one of the most deadly venoms in the world?
The blue-ringed octopus is quite toxic. The cone snail is another one. For spiders, you've got the Sydney funnel web and the red-back widow. You've obviously got your bark scorpions. It's quite a lot.
Well, I've got down here the box jellyfish.
Oh, yeah, that is
considered to be among the most deadly of toxins and venoms in the world. It attacks the heart, nervous system and skin cells. It's so overpoweringly painful that human victims have been known to go into shock and drown or die of heart failure before even reaching the shore. So it has 15 tentacles, up to 15 tentacles grow from each corner of the bell and can reach 10 feet in length. And each tentacle has 5,000 stinging cells, which are triggered not by touch, but the presence of a chemical on the outer layer of its prey, which I thought was quite fascinating.
Yeah, jellyfish are always interesting because they don't really have a brain either. They're just sort of like they don't really have powered swimming. They just float about. And
yeah, I seem to then go into all of this research about which invertebrates are really bad for you.
Basically, you've
like
just
assassin
gone
assassin bugs. And freshwater snails, would you believe, cause 200,000 deaths a year?
This episode should be called Dad Goes Down Invertebrate Rabbit Holes.
Do you know what invertebrate kills more humans than any other animal on the planet?
You're not counting mosquitoes and malaria?
I'm talking mosquitoes.
Okay, because I always feel a bit bad because it's through a disease they carry rather than through like their own toxin.
Yeah, but they're responsible for between 750,000 and 1,000,000 deaths a year.
Yeah, but it's not the mosquito. It's something that they carry rather than, you know, like the most toxic.
Yeah, they're still pretty bad for you, aren't they?
Yeah, it's not great.
Yeah. So, but freshwater snails kill more than 200,000 people a year.
Yeah.
Because they're host to deadly parasites, apparently. In particular, parasitic flatworms known as flukes.
Cone snails are very venomous, and the problem is they're also quite pretty. So you have divers, for example, who will be like, oh, look at that nice shell. They'll pick it up.
Yeah, no, this one really is just from contaminated water because they've released these flukes into the water, and then we go and drink fresh water and it kills 200,000 people. Anyway, snail fever, it's a thing. What else have I got?
I feel like I'm in a fever dream.
Assassin bugs. Assassin bugs kill 10,000 people a year globally. Did you know that?
I did not. My friend
through
kept
its bite.
Them.
Yeah.
He had pet assassin bugs.
It causes Chagas disease.
Yeah,
it's a tropical disease, obviously.
He had a bunch of them. They're really aggressive, but
they're
very cool.
They're often also called the kissing bug because they tend to bite people's faces as they sleep.
Right, I'm just going
to... Do we need to cheer this episode up a little bit now, don't we?
I'm going to do a cool case study because otherwise we're going to go down another snail fever dream. So I went looking for articles. Your story about the invasive ant species impacting lions and zebras sort of made me think there's got to be other incredible examples where an invertebrate almost changes the behaviour of other animals or has a real impact on the ecosystem. And so the rabbit hole I went down was termites. And specifically, you know, you see the David Attenborough documentaries, you get those huge termite mounds in like the African savannah where they're, I think comparatively or relative to their size, it's like bigger than all the skyscrapers that we've made, those sorts of things. So rather than just being like a home for the termites, they've actually, I didn't realize how central they are to the ecological sort of dynamics of the entire environment. And so, I mean, this could have been a whole episode. You've got things like they enhance soil fertility because of the organic material, the way that it mixes to sort of construct the mound, enriches the soil with nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus, which then makes the surrounding area a lot more fertile. You've got water infiltration and retention, so it improves the ability of the soil to hold water and again increasing the ability for plants to grow because they've now got rich soil and more water. And a bunch of other things like that. But really the bit I wanted to dial in on is because of the soil improvement and water retention, you get a lot more plant growth around the area that's full of termite mounds. And that then attracts things, all the herbivores. So it attracts things like antelope, elephants, zebras, especially during like your dry seasons where everywhere else is sort of completely desiccated, but you've got this nice moisture holding soil. They called it nutritional oases because... because they create such a diverse array of vegetation in areas, sort of little pockets where everywhere else is sort of completely desiccated. And so you do basically get these large herbivores choosing regions with lots of termites, which then obviously in turn attracts all your carnivores. So they create these really rich environments and ecological chains wherever they go. And so you think, oh, it's just termite mounds, but actually they are crucial for the health of all the animals around them. And I always thought, you know what, termites probably aren't as, apart from, you know, for anteaters and things like that, they're quite self-contained. You maybe you're not expecting them to have such wide-reaching effects within their little castles, but actually they're fundamental to the health of the whole savannah. I've got more. I mean, they provide shelter and habitat for reptiles and amphibians, especially abandoned termite mounds. They're crucial for certain burrowing species of amphibians during like dry periods. You also have things like aardvarks, mongoose and warthogs, which will use them as shelter, the mound that is for shelter. And I mean, the aardvarks actually quite like to just go and eat them as well. So, but beyond being a food source, they are creating the soil and the habitat for all the plants.
Fantastic. That's why they're so important.
Really cool.
And of course, we haven't even touched on the fact that invertebrates are so important for breaking down waste.
We haven't.
And, you know, because, again, there was a thing that I read that if it wasn't for invertebrates, the planet would be a pretty stinky place, actually.
I mean, even beyond the standard, you know, flies and everything that consumes waste and excrement, there are certain places that will use dung beetles on agricultural land because they're so effective. It reduces disease buildup and illness for like cattle and stuff because the dung beetles are there as your
they
your
are
bin
so
men.
Good at breaking down waste. And actually, there's a research being done. They think invertebrates could help break down billion tons of plastic waste.
Yes, I did see that.
There's a certain, the larva of the Zophobus morio beetle species was capable of digesting polystyrene, which in itself is incredible. That was something I forgot to say about when I was talking about the coral reef. More than 500 million people depend on reefs around the world for food protection and their livelihoods. Their natural barriers to storms, flooding and erosion, safeguarding human settlements while also providing a home for thousands of fish species, and invertebrates are crucial reef builders. And that is amazing. I didn't realise that 500 million people depend on reefs for their livelihood and for food.
Yeah, I think especially when so many reefs are coastal, they're full of fish.
They're abundant with fish, aren't they? So,
I mean, there's loads we haven't touched on. We haven't spoken about the importance of worms in soil health and the amount of carbon
that
is stored within soil. So again, you've got invertebrates crucial to our climate resilience. you've also got people and communities all around the world that rely on them as a food source. Obviously, you've got all of the pest control, from ladybirds to all sorts of things that you can bring into as a natural pest control on farms and everything like that. So pretty much every aspect of life at some stage, I think, you can put down to an invertebrate.
And of course, like, is my thing, I've got some cultural references as well.
There's loads.
There are quite a few. And obviously insects have been used, they have symbolic implications, they've been used in art and body tattoos, for example, in the past, jewellery, textiles, weapons, paintings, architecture, and even fashion. But there's lots of cultural references. Native American mythology sees swarms of insects as a sign of bad luck, but smaller individual insects symbolise meekness and humility. To the ancient Egyptians, various insects were revered, especially dung scarabs, which they actually put in with their mummies. They buried in their sarcophaguses.
And unlike the mummy film, they don't bury under your skin.
They don't go under your skin like that. So the ant, for example, holds great symbolism for many cultures. In the Philippines, it's a signal of wealth and prosperity. In China, they symbol patriotism, loyalty and duty.
Can I just say really quickly, I'm pretty sure ants are one of the only animals that, other than us, that have been known to go to war.
Yes, actually, I've seen them go to war with termites.
Well, those with other ant colonies as well. Other they ant will go and raid. And it's not like...
That's not like the wasps going into the beehives. No, that's a different thing, isn't it?
That they're going in for food more than anything. These are ants going into conflict. And it's proper warfare.
So it's tribal.
Yeah.
The butterfly has many symbolic references, obviously symbolic of transformation and in some cases the afterlife. Dragonfly. I didn't know that the dragonfly was the national emblem of Japan. Did you know that?
I didn't know that either.
In Japanese culture, the dragonfly symbolises not only light and joy, but also serves as the protector of children and samurais.
I think I've spoken before that if... One of the things I'd love to be able to see is the prehistoric dragonfly that has a metre long wingspan.
Yeah.
If we get Sean on the podcast, which I know we very much hope to do so, he's always said that if he could see any prehistoric animal, and this is coming from a dinosaur fanatic, he would love to have seen the giant
dragonfly. Watch out
dragonfly.
For that episode, because that's going to happen this year, because I've spoken to Sean and he's going to be here, aren't you, Sean? Dragonflies are often used in Japanese artwork, and because they're seen frequently flying around rice paddies, they became known as the rice spirit.
Oh, that's cool.
Which is really cool. Native Americans, the dragon symbolised the soul. Dragonfly symbolised the souls of the dead. Grasshoppers. Grasshoppers for ancient Greeks symbolised royalty and nobility. In China, the grasshopper and cricket symbolised good fortune, abundance and cheerfulness, which I thought was great. And the praying mantis. Do you know all about the praying mantis? It symbolises the power of stillness, patience and mindfulness. In Chinese culture, it suggests that a praying mantis means that one must not make a move until they're absolutely sure it's the right one.
I mean, I've seen quite a lot of them fly into windows.
And I could go on and on, but spiders, of course, lots of symbolism with spiders. Not just in sort of, they don't just appear in Harry Potter films.
Not completely random, but just as a little side note, if anybody really loves all this insect chat and also enjoys a good fantasy book, read The Shadows of the Apt, because each race of being is based on a different invertebrate.
What's the name of that book?
It's a series called The Shadows of the Apt. And so each race is based on an invertebrate, like the warrior class are like your ants and your wasps, and the spiders are like assassins and stuff. And it was written by a guy who was an entomologist, and they are cracking. So if you've really ended up loving all of this insect invertebrate, I would highly recommend going read
The
Shadows of
the
Apt.
It might be the other way, because, creepy crawlies are not people's thing, really.
Well, they should be.
Unless you're an entomologist. In China, spotting a spider is considered to bring good luck and happiness. In African mythology, the spider is associated with the trickster or person with cunning skills. So anyway, there's tons and tons of symbolism, but there are also, just to finish off with that, what I quite liked when I was doing the research on this is there are lots and lots of references to invertebrates and insects in our day-to-day sayings, like hive of activity, busy as a bee, you get a real buzz, I've got ants in my pants. A flyer being a fly on the wall. He's got the attention span of a gnat. Oh, snug as a bug in a rug. Having butterflies in one's stomach before giving a talk, for example. So there are lots and lots of really cool like references that. In our day-to-day sayings, you know, that include invertebrates. So,
yeah, I like that a lot. That's really cool.
So, and being a bookworm.
Oh, yeah, of course.
There's another one. So I could go on and on. There are so many symbolic references and cultural references to insects going back thousands of years, and particularly with art as well. And of course, we've got Spider-Man, Ant-Man.
You know, Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Exactly. So invertebrates are cool, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, they are the reason I sort of went down the road that I did, because I loved spiders and creepy crawlies.
Entomology Society?
I did.
Entomology Society.
I ran the Entomology Society.
The Entomology Society at Bangor University.
Yeah, and do you know who ran it before me? Sean.
Sean, get here.
Yes, I did, and it was great. I ended up finding all sorts of people at university who loved insects and inverts just as much as me, and so we spent a lot of our evenings out looking for spiders, and a great time up on like the Great Orne looking for purse web spiders, which is the UK's only quote-unquote tarantula or myaglomorph spider. That was really cool. Didn't see one, but it's not the point.
And driving home from the NEC with a minibus full of invertebrates.
Yeah. So they've played a big part in my life as well. But I think, you know, they continue to do so. Obviously, as we spoke about, I've moved on to the point where I work obviously very much around rivers, and things like stoneflies and caddisflies and lots of water invertebrates are key markers for healthy waterways. They become a real ecological sort of marker that you go out and look and survey, because if they start disappearing, it's a good sign.
It's a real indicator,
yeah,
isn't it?
It's a good sign that something's going wrong, because like we've spoken throughout the episode, they are the backbone of the ecosystem for fish and birds and everything else that eats them. So wherever you go in sort of nature, environment, world, insects are always there playing a role, which is great for me, because it means I can always find an excuse to talk about them.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of me done on little references. Have you got anything else you want to chat about?
No.
We're then going to go on and do our normal thing and talk about, you know, why they're under threat. Because I think we need to make reference to that, because we've made reference to the incredible abundance, or given you an impression of the incredible abundance of invertebrates on the planet. But actually, you know, the overall picture isn't a particularly good one, is it?
No, it's not. And I haven't got too much on specific threats, because it's hard to talk about real specifics when we're covering the entire group that is invertebrates. But obviously, I've mentioned that about 41% of insect species are declining globally. We've also got one third being threatened with extinction. Yeah. And it's all the stuff we always talk about. It's habitat loss, it's pesticide use, it's climate change, it's pollution, it's invasive species disrupting ecosystem, it's change of land use, which obviously goes hand in hand with habitat loss. But they are, when I say change of land use, you're going from nice, diverse forests and woodlands to just monoculture crop areas.
Lots of all those wildflower meadows and woodland and hedgerows.
So there's lots of things like that. We've spoken about how the changing in sort of global temperatures is impacting insect emergence times. And then if they come out early and the plants haven't caught up, they lose their food. So they're under threat from really every angle.
And of course, the marine invertebrates are under threat from pollution, from overfishing, the freshwater invertebrates are again, pollution of the water, agricultural runoff, which is affecting so many, the life cycle of so many invertebrates.
Yeah, you've spoken about corals, and obviously famously bleaching as water temperatures increase and acidity levels change.
Happening to the Great Barrier Reef a lot, actually.
A lot of it's sadly dying. The huge one, which is often overlooked, is unhealthy soils, which again comes from growing large monoculture sort of crops and lots of agricultural practices where the soil is not healthy enough to sustain your sort of beetle larvae and worms and all sorts of things that live underground. We can talk about more sort of local stuff. You've got the bane of our life, which is plastic grass. You've got a lack of green spaces in urban areas where people are paving over vital things. I think obviously in one of our previous gardens where we were really lucky because we had stag beetles, they struggled to get through the mesh that was put down for gravel, which we then had to take up so that the beetles could emerge. So
yes, that was a big mistake that I made, which I didn't realise at the time.
Because they had a big rotting log, didn't you? And they'd obviously gone through it. But if people move in and then decide they're going to put a membrane down so they can gravel a driveway and you've actually got loads of beetle grub under there.
Yeah, I very quickly took that up.
Yeah, because we could actually hear them trying to get through. And then we were, like I say, so lucky because we had stag beetles in our garden. But all sorts of things like that, even if people are not doing it intentionally, impact the populations of our insects. However, unless you've got more on threats, that does move on to some of the stuff that we can do, which is cool.
No, I've just got, I mean, there's been lots of studies on trying to monitor the decline in invertebrates, and apparently during the period of 1970 to 2019, a total of 4,757 samples containing 2.98 million invertebrates were collected from cereal fields across a study area. This is in this country. And it showed a drop in overall abundance of 37%, with varying levels of decline in different invertebrate groups. But lots of beneficial predators, including ground beetles and ladybirds, fell significantly. And aphids, which are food for a wide range of invertebrates, dropped by 90%. And of course, we talked about threatened species, particularly birds, ground nesting birds, and why our bird population is declining so much. And of course, this ripple effect, you know, that loss of invertebrates in our countryside. And we talked about bats as well, didn't we? One of the reasons for the decline in bats is
loss
of insects in our gardens and our fields. And so it is the normal thing, but actually, even though we've talked about so much abundance, the decline is really dramatic.
Yeah, it's huge. And I mentioned right at the beginning that really there could potentially be another 80% of undescribed insect species. But a lot of those may never be described because we are losing so many of them all the time. And we might not even understand how many we're losing because we haven't even found them yet.
I reckon that we've learned that in the UK we've lost 73 million wild birds, and farmland species have shown the biggest overall decline of 60%. And in the first few weeks of life of the chicks of farmland species, they're so dependent on things like sawflies and ground beetles and weevils. And those invertebrates depend so much on arable flora in cereal fields. So it's a massive ripple effect.
But in a way, it's nice. Not nice that there's a decline, but it's nice to know that if you support the insects, that you're supporting everything else.
Yeah.
So if you can look after a patch, or if we can bring in measures to help our insect populations, that ripple effect is reversed because it starts helping all of our bird and bat and everything else. So yes, it's not good if we take the insects out, but if we help them, you're helping everything.
Yeah. And just one last stat about the decline. The UK's flying insect population has declined by as much as 60% in the last 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken in I think I actually mentioned it in a Good News episode about the decline of British butterflies, but I mentioned it because then some were bouncing back because of a rewilding project. Yeah. So that's how it was turned into Good News. But we've lost a lot of butterfly species and things like that. But on that, actually, as a positive story, so I said some butterfly species have bounced back. One of the things that's really helping that is through gardening. And we've spoken lots. I mean, it was our very, very first episode was about how to rewild your garden. Yeah. And I've said, obviously, at the beginning of this episode that I finally got my own garden. And so I'm really looking for, we've been out buying plants today because it means that you're going to come and help me plant up a garden because I don't really know what I'm doing. But a UK study confirmed that, you know, letting your grass grow a bit longer can almost double butterfly numbers, especially if you're surrounded by intentionally farmed areas. This research was based on 6 years of butterfly sightings from about 600 gardens, and it really was one of the big things that supported the whole No Mow May campaign because you can double your butterflies by just not cutting your grass for a month. Gardens with long grass showed a 93% increase in butterflies in rural settings and an 18% increase in urban areas.
It's quite dramatic, isn't it?
Yeah, and so it just shows such a small measure. And again, we've mentioned, I think, the incredible stat that all of our gardens added up is like bigger than a national park or bigger than
of the national parks put together.
Yeah, so
why it's so important.
If you think of how much land that is, if all of us have a little pocket of greenery with some long grass and some wildflowers and a butterfly water station, then we each individually can do so much for our native insects, which then means you do so much for your native birds and bats and mammals.
And if you can, try and put native plants and trees in your garden. And I've been doing that in my little patch here, and I don't have a very big garden, but I've put hawthorn and crabapple and native flowering plants in, and I've had so many more bees and butterflies and hoverflies coming in this year. So where you can, put a hawthorn tree in if you can, and as many native plants as you can put in. They don't have to be big. But yeah, leaving your grass to grow is a great thing too.
Yeah, it's always a reassuring thing for me, I think, because sometimes, you know, we each have such a small pocket of land.
Yeah.
But it can make such a massive impact.
Massive difference.
You can sometimes sit and feel a little bit hopeless when you're reading the stats of our insects declining, our birds declining, all the bad things that are going on. And you can feel a bit like, well, what can I do? And it's like, well, actually, you can do loads.
Yeah,
and the impact of your garden, especially if everybody starts doing it, is massive.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of takes us on to, there's lots of positive things that are being done. Some great organisations. I'm sure you've heard of Bug Life.
Yeah, Bug Life's brilliant.
And there's a citizen science survey between the 1st of May and September the 30th. And I love the way you do this. It's an important initiative measuring insect splats on vehicle number plates as a marker of insect abundance. They've been doing this every year and I didn't realise. In previous survey years, with valuable contributions of citizen scientists across the UK, they've made significant strides in understanding the challenges facing our insect populations. And the concept's simple. You clean the number plate before making your journey in your vehicle. When you reach your destination, count the number of bug splats across your entire number plate. And then there's a virtual splatometer, which is a Bugs Matter app. You can get the app. And you get the best photograph of that as you can. Upload the photograph and the details to the app. You don't even have to be the driver, it says here. And the app also includes a tutorial and some safety advice. So there are little things like that are being done.
You can obviously also get involved in things like the big butterfly count.
Absolutely. And there's another one called Invertebrates on the Edge. Invertebrates on the Edge, which is also working with Bug Life, carries out essential conservation work to create more safe havens for threatened species and restore lost populations through empowering local communities. So again, it's that nice education thing that we've talked about lots and lots. There's Insect Week being done by the Royal Entomological Society that goes from 23rd to 29th of June 2025. Again, it's an educational thing. Insect Week encourages people of all ages to learn more about insects. Organises a week supported by a large number of partner organisations with the interest in science, natural history and conservation of insects. Again, it's a citizen science thing. You can go on. We'll put links to that.
Yeah, there are loads of things people can get involved in.
Lots and lots of things. And there are some now, a bit like we have sites of scientific special interest in this country, we also have important invertebrate areas, places that are home to nationally or internationally significant invertebrate populations and their habitats. We keep increasing those, the amount of those, a bit like we're doing with, you know, RSPB sites and what have you. And I think there are over 100 now in England, Scotland and Wales. They're obviously, you know, trying to protect and improve the habitats to obviously increase the invertebrate species. So there's lots and lots of ways you
can get out and help our invertebrate populations.
The Native Invertebrate Recovery Centre, which is a groundbreaking new species restoration project, which is being set up in Devon. And it's going to be the country's first dedicated breeding facility for native invertebrates.
Oh, that's really cool. I mean, if you go back and listen to some of our positive news story episodes, I've thrown in quite a few invertebrate related stories, from butterflies bouncing back to beetles and spiders that have been found for the first time in years. So if you want to go listen to our little backlog of episodes, there's all sorts of cool insects stories sprinkled throughout. So there are good things happening as well.
There's lots of projects out there trying to save and look after and protect the invertebrates, because as we've discussed, they're vital.
Yeah, and I think hopefully what you've got from this probably slight fever dream of an episode where we've hopped over all sorts of facts, figures, topics, cool insect mutualistic relationships, yeah. parasites, snail fever, the whole lot, is that the scope of the impact of the invertebrates on the world, from us to environment to ecology, is just really quite mind-blowing. And you can just go down rabbit hole after rabbit hole, being like, blimey, they are just fascinating.
Oh, I went down so many rabbit holes. I've watched about 6 videos now of army ants. Oh my, I just watch army ants just rampaging across a countryside, across a jungle floor.
Yeah, so.
And also the Goliath bird-eating spider, which is just unbelievably massive.
Yeah, I think that
will get over your arachnophobia, or actually might take you the other way.
So, yes, they are abundant and just mind-blowing.
So fascinating.
So hopefully you've enjoyed learning about some of the random facts and case studies that we found, because it's been really fun to research.
It was a bit of a scatterbomb episode, that wasn't it?
But yeah, but hopefully it sort of highlights how taken we are with the stories. I've
also learned so much in such a short space of time, so I've really enjoyed
one of those things where we've read loads and just been like, we just want to get some of this out there. So really, hopefully you at least come away with a newfound interest or respect for certain invertebrates, understanding that apparently shrimp lay quite a few eggs.
Not 137.
And join us next time for our big 50, which we should probably get planning.
We should get planning, because it's probably going to be in a couple of weeks. So we haven't got much time to do that.
But as always, social media stuff, go find us on Instagram at @abuginthelens. Nope, that's my Instagram. The Birdie Bug.
Are you plugging that before the Birdie Bug Pod?
Go look at my photos. No, sorry, our podcast is obviously at the Birdie Bug Pod on Instagram. If you fancy dropping us a message or a review or anything like that, that's always really appreciated. And if you've got your favourite insect fact that we haven't touched on, then drop it in the comments or send it to us.
Get bugs in your garden.
Yes, do that. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for listening. Catch you for our big, big episode.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.